This week on Making Contact.
The future of California farming will be different than farming today. The question is, how far in advance are we going to start planning for these changes?
Climate change is upon us. The world's water supply is shrinking. And increasingly, local organic food is becoming more than just a fad or a luxury for wealthy foodies. On this edition, we go to California, America's leading producer of fruits, vegetables, and dairy, to see some examples of how the nation's agricultural industry is slowly but surely moving away from factory farms.
The solutions are not exclusively local, but I believe that ultimately resource issues are going to direct more and more people toward organic solutions.
I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. It's been said that California is an optical illusion. The hundreds of miles of coastline and countless rivers and streams obscure the fact that much of the state is a desert. It's a historical quirk that the middle of that desert, California's Central Valley, has been made into an artificial agricultural oasis. The world's largest irrigation system brings water to hundreds of farms. As you may have heard, there's been increasing controversy in the last few years about whether that irrigation can continue at such high levels. But the bottom line is that farmers in the Central Valley are getting a sneak preview of what much of the country and the world can expect to see in the next few decades: increasing water scarcity. So how to handle a dry outlook ahead? To look into one idea, correspondent Joaquin Palomino visited the nearby Central Coast growing region. It's about 2 hours from the Central Valley, and it isn't yet as dry, but the availability of water is a growing issue there, too. And a handful of farmers are finding new ways to make every last drop count.
See, these guys, you just, like, pop that one off. That guy's gonna get nice and big.
That's Joe Shermer, walking us through his 20-acre tomato and vegetable farm in Watsonville, California, a small agricultural town on California's Central Coast.
It's going to be an ocean of green, and then an ocean of red, and then an ocean of decaying, dying tomato plant that just is going to totally dry out, and then back to being soil. We'll cover crop it.
The farm is called Dirty Girl Produce, and at first glance, it doesn't look much different than other farms. There's a tractor in the back of the field, and rows of tomato plants are just starting to break through the dirt. But if you take another look, you might be surprised.
And we're not watering, you know. You don't have to walk over it once a week with big pipe or lay all this plastic tape that then gets into the landfill, you know. I mean, there's so many things that are so satisfying about standing over a field of dry farm tomatoes.
What Joe is doing is called dry farming. People have been doing it for as long as they've been growing food, and it's starting to see a resurgence in California. The tomatoes that Joe grows here use almost no irrigated water, just the rain, carefully stored in the soil through the winter and spring.
And what'll happen with this soil on the surface, this topsoil, it's just gonna be bone dry. It's gonna be super dry. But you could come out here in September with a shovel and dig down a foot, and you already see moisture. There'll still be moisture down there. Versus if you just let it go, you know, you just had a fallow field and you dug down in September, it would just be bone dry. It'd be super hard, and all the moisture would be gone. So we're just holding that in, and that's
what we're on the Central Coast, the home of the redwood. So we see a good amount of rain throughout the winter and spring. And Joe works hard to trap as much of that water as he can into the soil. He does it by covering the ground with mulch to keep the winter rains from evaporating in the dry summer season. He plants his tomatoes as far down as he can, because these plants are going to need to dig their roots deep. Once the summer comes, they might not feel a drop of water for the rest of their lives. So they need to travel far, sometimes 10 feet down, in search of every last drop of water.
These plants are not going to realize that they're dry farmed until, you know, middle to the end of June. In the meantime, they're just going to be spoiled little brats. They're just going to be happy. They have so much compost fertilizer, you know, custom compost blend. And they'll grow up about 4 feet to 5 feet. and just looks super good. And then all of a sudden you get a heat wave and towards the end of June, beginning of July, and they really start feeling it. You know, they don't have just an indefinite amount of water that is easily accessible at the surface. And a lot of people will look at it and go, oh my God, your tomatoes, they're dying. They have disease or something. Like, nope, they're just dry farm. That's what they do. They just come up and they all of a sudden transform into tomato production and they just get loaded with fruit.
This plant gives up on growing pretty leaves and it focuses all of its energy on making fruit. And this fruit is unlike any other tomato you have tasted.
When you dry farm them, they're super juicy and they get real high acid and high sugar and also a real mineral quality because it's really mining the soil and every drop of water that's coming up is going to be that much more filled with nutrients and not watered down. You know, it has to work harder so it's bringing up other stuff as it's going.
Growing food without irrigation is common in other parts of the country. All throughout the Midwest, thousands of acres of wheat fields are dry farmed. But here in California, where much of the state is a semi-desert, most farmers use water as if there were an infinite supply.
California is one of the most productive agricultural states in the nation. About 80% of our total developed supply goes to agriculture.
That's Juliet Christian Smith, a senior research associate with the Pacific Institute, a nonprofit working to find a sustainable future for California agriculture.
Because agriculture is so water intensive in California, it will be one of the first sectors to feel the impacts of climate change, and it will be one of the sectors that really has to be a leader in terms of becoming more efficient in water use and setting the path for other industries.
California grows nearly half of all of the fruits, vegetables, and nuts in the country. And California's Central Valley, a long strip right in the middle of the state, grows the bulk of it. But that might not be true for much longer. While weather patterns change from year to year, some drier and some wetter, the long-term prognosis for California's Central Valley is that the climate will get hotter and drier. Climate scientists predict that summer temperatures could exceed 120 degrees, winter rains could diminish, and the rushing spring snowmelt from California's Sierra Mountains could reduce by as much as 90% by 2050. In the face of all of this, many farmers are struggling to hold on to their traditional way of life.
Don't expect big changes to suddenly appear upon the scene when we talk about California agriculture in particular.
Bill Friedland, Professor Emeritus of Community Studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz.
If you study California agriculture, one of the things you learn is the sheer size of the big agribusiness firms. These are enormous corporations. They're not going to go out of business just because times are hard. They're going to try to figure out ways to survive. So we may be moving into a slightly different kind of system where we get continual experimental activity in agriculture around the edges.
You can grow a huge, lush, beautiful crop without any water at all. People have a tendency, growers, people that are learning how to garden and farm, have a tendency to think more is better. So if I add a little bit of water, it's really good, but if I add more water, it's even better.
That was Jim Leap, the head of the University of California at Santa Cruz's Agroecology Center. He teaches hundreds of students dry farming techniques every year.
When I take the students out and show them those dry farm tomato plants, and we're standing there looking at these plants, and they're just some of the biggest, most beautiful plants on the whole farm. And then I say, okay, and now remember that these haven't had any irrigation. It helps them kind of rethink how they might approach irrigation.
A lot of these places that are having, you know, heavy water issues right now, people are like flood irrigating. You know, it's ridiculous.
We are back on Joe Shermer's farm on California's Central Coast.
So the amount of conservation that can be done is immense.
Joe's farm is tiny compared to the big ag businesses of the Central Valley, and he's in a much wetter region. But there's still a lot that the big boys can learn from Joe's technique. And it sets an example that things can be done differently and still be profitable, because somewhere along the way, many of the fields that cover California have separated themselves from nature. A strange notion, because when you think about it, what's more natural than growing food. For Making Contact, I'm Joaquin Palomino in Watsonville, California.
Now we'll head over to the city of Modesto, California, about an hour's drive west of Yosemite National Park. It's estimated that dairy products make up a full 20% of our daily food intake here in North America. But with increased focus on cattle waste methane emissions as a factor in climate change, the dairy industry is facing intense scrutiny. Making Contact's Rita Daniels takes us to one sustainable California dairy farm where solutions are being found and where waste, as it turns out, makes all things possible.
It's 4:30 in the morning, and I'm standing on the driveway of Fiscalini Farms in Northern California's Central Valley. The sun isn't quite up. The smell of sweet feed meets my nose as tiny raindrops splatter against the cultivated fields where that very feed is grown. I can make out a group of 150 calves right in front of me, greeting me with a low chorus of moos. I've driven out here in the middle of the night through miles of almond and cherry orchards to meet the farm's managers as their day begins. I'm going to spend the day finding out just what it takes to run a dairy, and, more importantly, what makes Fiscalini Farms a model for the future.
I'm Brian Fiscalini. I'm the fourth generation dairy farmer of Fiscalini Farms. We're located in Modesto, California, where we milk 1,500 Holstein cows, and we have a small cheese plant. And we've been here since 1914.
Today, Brian starts his morning by checking up on some of his soon-to-be mama cows. He wears a rubber glove that covers his entire arm, and he is, shall we say, shoulder deep inside this female heifer. It's obvious he's a hands-on kind of guy.
What do you do with the male cows?
The male calves, we call them bull calves, sold at birth, so we don't raise any bull calves here.
Brian's great-grandfather was a dairyman in Switzerland, who immigrated to California at the turn of the last century. He started this farm with 10 cows.
I mean, at that time, a 10-cow dairy was a relatively good-sized dairy.
Due to federal and state marketing orders regulating raw milk prices, these days, most producers end up getting paid for only about 30% of their raw milk product.
If you're a dairyman and you dairy in California, you are a part of the California milk pool. As a producer, you do not have a decision whether you participate in it or not.
Milk pooling is a government-regulated pricing structure for dairy milk that tends to swing wildly, making the economics of farming a real challenge. Fiscalini Farm has expanded over the years trying to keep up with the times. They've installed new technology, upgraded their facilities, and slowly expanded their herd to its current count of more than 1,500. But despite the proficiency of the farm's herd, neither Brian or his father, John, were seeing any of the profits until recently.
In 2000, my dad started a Fiscalini Cheese Company.
He hired Mariano Gonzalez as his award-winning cheesemaker. Mariano grew up in Paraguay and learned to make cheese at an early age.
I'm Mariano, the head cheesemaker.
We started filling the vat with the milk.
We're gonna add our enzyme that's gonna coagulate the milk, wait 40 minutes, and then cook the curds.
Real curds and whey.
And then we will draw all the whey out of those curds.
Compressing the cheese to take out more whey.
And we'll stretch our cheese into mozzarella.
The smacks are like good luck, saying our cheese is gonna grow very strong.
We break a little piece and we taste it. It's a lot of complexity.
The success of their cheese business made Fiscalini Farms economically viable for the first time in years. The Fiscalinis took another step towards sustainability by building and installing a methane digester. Outside the cheese plant, John starts to talk about the digester when...
This is going to be a little tricky. You got good shoes on?
Okay.
This is going to be a little slippery.
Dash indoors and then we'll talk about it while we're inside.
We're standing in a small room between two giant cylindrical tanks. And just outside the door is a pool of circulating stinky brown water. I ask him to explain how it works.
So when they defecate, the manure lands on these concrete lanes and then
7 times a day we wash with a large volume of water. We run water down that lane about 6 inches deep. That picks up all of the manure and transports it down into our system here.
Brian says the very water that is used to flush the lanes is recycled in this process.
You know, there's so many different ways that dairy farms recycle that a lot of people don't understand. All of the manure that the cows produce in a day that we flush down our flush lanes with our recycled flush water gets collected here at the digester.
We run that water over what's called a slope screen separator, which separates the large solid particles from the small solid particles and the water. We pick up the large particles with a front-end loader and put them into a hopper, which augers them into the digester tanks.
The digester tanks hold the manure and any leftover uneaten feed from the cows, as well as the whey byproduct from the cheese-making process.
Both tanks are running at 101 degrees. That temperature is high enough and the time is long enough to kill all pathogenic bacteria. Part of the process of doing that, one of the byproducts of breaking that down, is methane. And then we have an intricate piping system that pulls the methane out of the tanks and blows it to the engine.
The engine runs off of the methane and converts it into electricity. The farm uses about half of it and sells the rest back to the local public utility agency. They say it's enough electricity to power about 300 homes in the community.
Yeah, I think of all of the renewable energies, you know, this one, in my opinion, you know, should hold the most promise because solar only works during the day. Wind turbines only work when it's windy. This thing works 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And it takes products that, you know, normally would be discarded in one form or another and actually produces electricity out of them. If every large dairy farmer in the United States would put one of these things in, I mean, think of the amount of electricity we could produce, the decreased reliance we would have on fossil fuels and whatever.
Besides electricity, there are actually several byproducts of this process.
Part of running an engine means you have to have a way to get rid of the heat that the engine produces. We take the heat that the engine produces and pipe that heat in the form of hot water back to the tanks to heat the two tanks.
John's referring to the digester tanks here.
Then we have 1,000 gallons of 200-degree hot water stored to use to wash our dairy barn instead of using propane to heat the water.
And in the end, once the methane is captured and converted into electricity, there is a fibrous material left in the tanks that can be used and sold as well.
We are taking what is truly considered to be a waste product and transforming it into a saleable product and at the same time producing renewable energy. We have reduced, you know, the carbon footprint of our dairy. We have removed methane emissions, CO2 emissions.
Brian will ultimately be the one responsible for the future of this farm. As we take one more walk through the barn stalls, he has this to say.
I kind of learned how to love dairy and how to love everything that we're doing here. I guess you could say we've been innovative. We've taken the steps that we needed to become one of the few dairies in the United States that has a digester. The control of your waste products is going to be a very huge issue.
With a degree in animal science and dairy, Brian is heading back to school next year for another degree. This one will be in business.
Before, as dairymen, we didn't have to market our milk. The state of California went ahead and did that for us, where now we have our cheese plant with my name on it, and my family is solely responsible for the marketing of that product, so we need to have as much knowledge in that area as possible in order to be successful. There's a certain pride factor that you can associate when you walk into a grocery store and you see something with your name on it, and you know exactly where it came from. You were there from the day that calf was born till the day she made milk, till that milk went into our own cheese plant.
For Making Contact, I'm Rita Daniels, Modesto, California.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. So we've heard about some different ways to run a farm, but how about the people who do the farming? It's a well-known fact that people picking food all across the U.S. are predominantly low-paid Latino migrant workers. It's ironic that the workers caring for and picking our food have the least say about how the farms themselves are run. But a nonprofit organization in Central California is working to change that with a dynamic program that turns farm workers into farm operators and owners.
If it kills the flower, there's no fruit, there's no yield. You've got nothing.
In the midst of sprawling farmland in Salinas Valley sits a straw building with a classroom inside. 25 students are listening to a bilingual lesson about using pesticides versus organic farming.
Afectar cómo se prueba el sabor.
This is the first of a four-part course in farm management conducted by the Agriculture and Land-Based Training Association, abbreviated ALBA. This course is a graduation requirement. The students' reward, assuming they finish, will be a plot of land they can farm on and assistance getting into the farming business. But Gary Peterson, the deputy director at ALBA, says what's really special about the class is the students themselves.
The majority of our participants are field workers. And so in most cases, they're coming from a rural background, a family farm in Mexico, or some experiences on their grandparents' farms or whatnot. So people come in with inherent knowledge of, you know, the basics of how to grow things and produce. And here at ALBA, as we welcome people into the idea of starting their own small farm enterprise, you know, everybody needs to get their minds around, you know, this is going to be a whole spectrum of responsibilities.
Because of language and cultural divides, many farm workers, whether in the U.S. with or without proper documentation, tend to lay low and not seek educational or other advancement opportunities. ALBA's mission is to give people like Karina Canto a way to become her own boss instead of remaining stuck as a low-paid, often expendable worker.
Los betabeles rojos y están ya listos para cosechar.
Today, Canto's picking red beets, which are ready to be sold, and checking out her cilantro and broccoli, which should be ready soon. As part of ALBA's Farm Business Incubator Program, Canto's renting a half-acre plot of ALBA's land.
Mis padres son agricultores también en mi país.
My parents are in agriculture in my country of Peru. My love for cultivation comes from my ancestors, and I studied agriculture, and now I want to have my own business.
Quiero tener mi propio negocio.
Renting half an acre is the limit for first-year farmers, who also only have to pay 20% of market rate for the land they're working. Each year following, the price of the land goes up, and by the seventh year, they have to pay full market rate. It guarantees that they have to learn the business side of farming, which is crucial for survival.
Yo veo todas las cuentas.
I oversee the business accounts. I control everything, from buying rope to boxes and seeds.
Los amarres.
Canto says she's torn. On the one hand, she'd like to keep farming in California, but she'd also like to eventually bring her skills and pass them on to her family and community in Peru. Leveraging the knowledge and abilities gained, according to Peterson, is the bottom line for most ALBA participants.
So in this circumstance where people may be earning $16,000 to $20,000 per year as a field worker, ALBA does not offer the silver bullet to immediate riches, but we do offer a really pragmatic and proven strategy. What we've seen is, you know, a first-year farmer making $8,000 in sales off of their half acre to a nine-year farmer having her own salary as a result of her business being $70,000, having been a field worker just 10 years before. We feel like that's quite an achievement. And what the farmers are particularly proud of is the educational assets that they're able to share with their children because of the advancement of their careers here. And we have a lot of farmers here who are really proud of children entering colleges and being successful in those endeavors.
Efren Avalos is a proud example of ALBA's success. Ever since he was a kid, he helped his parents on their small farm in Michoacán, Mexico. So it made perfect sense that when he came to the U.S., he found work as a farm worker. For 12 years, Avalos picked strawberries and other produce in the fields of California for a large agricultural company.
They have the fields that they have to be picked every day.
and you don't go home until you finish picking the field. So sometimes 6 hours, sometimes 11, 12 hours, they were not organic. They had all the pesticides that they can put on it, a lot of them.
In fact, Avalos didn't even know what the term organic meant.
And then I heard about ALBA.
Avalos enrolled in classes at ALBA and began to understand the bigger picture of how to plan and maintain a farm.
So I learned how to drive tractors, how to water in properly. I learned that the best time to water in the plants is at evening or at night.
Once Avalos had the hands-on skills, he needed a place to sell his produce. ALBA buys crops from their participant farmers at set prices, making it easier than negotiating on the open marketplace. ALBA then does the work of reselling the produce to large buyers like universities and other distributors. But ALBA's farm incubators can also go out on their own. 10 years ago, Efron Avalos started selling at a farmer's market and never looked back. Just a few years later, his 17-acre Avalos Organic Farm in Hollister, California, was certified organic. They grow fruits and vegetables and nuts, and now Avalos sells his veggies at 5 regional farmers markets every week.
We are selling broccoli today. We have cauliflower also, summer squash, potatoes, cabbage.
It's not easy to find affordable land to buy or even rent and start your own operation. Sometimes ALBA helps fledgling farmers connect with a local resident who has land they're willing to lend out. Other times, farmers come to ALBA looking for field managers. The rewards are significant.
We're talking about a circumstance where somebody may have the potential to go from earning $20,000 a year in the best case scenario as a field worker to, you know, earning up to $50,000 or $60,000 as a foreman or manager of some sort with one of these agricultural companies.
ALBA seems to be on to something. There are twice as many applicants to its classes than it can accept. And perhaps more importantly, the participants are becoming part of the community.
Here in Salinas, a person can live in the informal economy in perpetuity if they so choose. And, you know, ultimately we believe that to help people to really invest themselves in the community, we need to help people step outside of the informal economy in any ways that we can.
In addition to teaching how to farm and run a business, ALBA works to connect low-income communities to healthy organic food. They have another program that teaches leadership skills, with an eye on having farmers influence public policy down the line. It's part of a holistic approach to a changing food system, one that Peterson says farm workers themselves must play a part in.
Transforming our food system is the most profound challenge we face, I believe, in the next 100 years as a society. And the trends that we see are a growing interest in people connecting with the sources of their food, growing interest in people understanding what their bioregion offers in terms of foodstuffs. And also we see that many small farmers who start today are not necessarily intending to grow a large farm.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Tina Rubio for producing part of this program. Check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.